supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later on the show, little black beetles appearing on tomatoes late in the season in a garden, seemingly doing damage. Are they the cause, or are they just showing up after the fact? We'll tell you about the strange case of the sap beetle later in the show. But first, there's lots of sappy phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing well. I am in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, in Elizabethtown.
Oh, very good. Out in the Amish country, some of the best topsoil in Pennsylvania. Great growing area out there.
Very much so.
What can we do for...
So here's my question, Mike. I recently was given a potted Canadian hemlock. It's in about a 10-inch plastic pot. And I asked the person who gave it to me what kind of spread this is going to have. He said it's going to have about a 25-foot spread. I don't have that kind of room in my yard. Right now, I drop it into a hole in the ground. Hopefully, it'll survive the winter. Is there any way I could put this in something like half a whiskey barrel, something that size? Or am I just going to have to find a good home for this somewhere else?
And how big is this thing?
Right now, it's probably about 8 to 10 inches tall in about a 10-inch plastic pot, maybe about a gallon pot.
Okay. Well, you certainly did the right thing when you have a potted plant like that that's a perennial and you have to punt. You know, you don't know what to do. Just dig a hole in the ground and drop the pot in. It's just remarkable how protective it can be to get those roots below the soil line. Now, long-term, hemlocks are big trees, but they're very slow-growing trees. I mean, they do like cold weather. Hemlocks in our area are suffering from a pest called the woolly adelgid, who's kind of an aphid with a big white fur coat on. And one of the issues has been the warm winters we had, you know, not the 2 years previous to this, but before that, we had a bunch of warm winters. And Canadian is not just a useless synonym with this tree. I mean, they really do prefer Arctic cold for winters. So they're real cold-loving plants. You know, it might survive in a half whiskey barrel, but I don't think either you or it would be really happy. If you don't have a lot of room, you can probably have better things to be growing. Did you ever consider trying to bonsai it?
That's kind of what I was thinking. I wasn't sure if that was all possible, though.
All things are possible now. The probability factor is another thing. But one great thing I can tell you is when we had a bonsai expert on the show in the very early years of our broadcasts, he said you only become a bonsai expert by killing trees. So you got nothing to lose, and you'd kind of be doing it at the right time of year. Do you ever get to the Philly Flower Show?
No, my teaching schedule makes it a little bit difficult to get there. I'd love to, but unfortunately not.
Well, you should at least visit their website, see who's doing the bonsai exhibitions there, and check in on the websites of some of the Pennsylvania bonsai associations. And I know you can bonsai a hemlock, but it would probably be what's called an outdoor bonsai, where you'd be doing this same thing, kind of, man. You'd be caring for it over the spring and summer. You'd be pruning the top back and you'd be pruning the roots. Maybe if you wanted to get really crafty, you'd get those little copper wires and you'd be sending the branches in the directions you wanted, kind of maybe give it a weeping shape. You could do anything you wanted. You know, again, if you kill it, it wasn't your fault. But over the winter, you would be doing pretty much the same thing. You'd be dropping the pot into the ground so it could experience winter outside. Your other big option, of course, would be to find a bare spot in the woods somewhere and plant it. It just occurs to me that if it's a nice looking tree and it's healthy, I've always, you know, been looking for that first step, that reason to do the bonsai? Because I don't have the personal courage to just, like, go into a place and say, all right, I'm going to do this. But, you know, somebody gives me custody of a little tree, I might try to keep it little. It could be fun. And you say you're a teacher?
Yes, I am.
What kind of teacher?
I teach high school physics.
Oh, okay. Well, that's, you know.
Mike, it's not contagious. Don't worry.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's got to be intersecting lines here someplace.
I am going to try that. I think my kids would very much enjoy trying to shape a tree like that.
Yeah, it could be. And again, if it doesn't work the first time, whoever gave you this one probably has an endless supply. You know, a lot of times you only get good at this with the experience of death. So, you know, by the time you got to your third or fourth one, you'd be really good at this.
Sounds great, Mike. Thank you very much for your help. I appreciate it.
All right. Good luck, Bill.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Stephanie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you could take my call.
Well, I'm glad you could make it. Stephanie, where are you?
I am in Bethany, Oklahoma. It's a suburb of Oklahoma City.
Oh, okay. I am pleased to tell you, this is probably the first time I'm announcing it this year on the show. I'm coming to Oklahoma for Earth Day.
Oh, that'll be fabulous.
I'm going to be at the University of Central Oklahoma on the day before Earth Day. And then on Earth Day itself, I'm going to be doing something for our station there, KGOU.
Oh. Well, you'll enjoy every minute you're here, I'm sure of it.
I've visited Oklahoma before. I love the people. I love your botanical garden. I don't miss your wind. But I love the listeners down there. I can't wait to see you guys again. So what can we do for you now?
Well, my husband bought me a citrus tree, and I have kept it alive indoors, outdoors, during the summer. The pots have gotten bigger. I'm now to like a whiskey barrel type pot. It's 2.5 feet. The tree is almost 6.5 feet tall. I've never had a fruit. I have gorgeous, pretty leaves. I have gigantic thorns. You know, it's
oh my goodness. Okay.
Test away. But I want to know if I'm having to move it indoors in the wintertime and then, of course, put it out in the summer. But it's getting a little too heavy to move. Winterize it.
Oh, no. I think he made a mistake somehow. What you're describing is what we would call a standard tree.
Okay.
You know, if you've ever vacationed in southern Florida, southern California, these trees are in everybody's backyard. Down in San Diego, everybody's got an orange tree and a lemon tree and a lime tree.
Right.
And the standard trees get to, you know, to be about 6-10 feet tall. And one thing people don't realize who don't live in a climate where these things grow naturally is how thorny they can get.
They're like, talk about keeping predators away. They're 3 inches long. They're horrible thorns.
And the trees typically have a beautiful form. But what I'm guessing he should have gotten would have been like the famous Meyer lemon or some other grafted plant, which would be the top part of a real tree, but grafted onto what we call a dwarfing rootstock that would keep the tree small. It should never have gotten this big. This is what you get if you plant the seed of a lemon.
I was thinking I was doing something wrong.
There's two things that could have gone wrong here. One is he just somehow got a standard tree instead of a dwarf tree. But if he brought home a true dwarf tree, and as you said, you've been potting it up into bigger containers.
If
you accidentally planted it so low that the graft went under the soil line, then the standard tree would take over and it wouldn't be a dwarf anymore. And it probably still has to grow another 2 or 3 feet before it's going to set fruit for you now.
Oh, my goodness. I don't think I can move around an 8-foot-tall tree.
Yeah, I think you're at the end of the line for moving this thing and out, right?
Yeah, it's got kind of heavy.
You know what I'm going to suggest is you wait until, like, June 1st. Drag this puppy outside into an area where it gets bright morning sun, maybe a little afternoon shade, because your wind and your conditions there can be a little rough. But make sure it gets great morning sun till like 2 in the afternoon. Give it a good feeding early in the season. Make sure it stays well watered. Feed the tree early in the spring. Get it outside into good light. Water it. And if we get to September and you still don't see a little flower on that thing, then I would just accidentally forget it was outside.
Yeah, I thought about that, maybe.
But it also sounds like you've kept it really healthy. So what I'm going to suggest is you already know how to do this now. So for Christmas or for whatever, hubby owes you a real dwarf lemon
that's
tree.
That's kind of what I'm thinking. I'm thinking maybe he owed it to me about 6 years ago.
Just make sure that if you choose to pot it up, that that graft line, that visible part where the two plants are spliced together, is always up in the air. Never bury the graft.
All right. Well, that sounds perfect. And I will definitely, I'll give it another go this summer, and maybe I'll have a tree on my Christmas wish list this year.
There you go. All right, Stephanie, good luck.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear on Saturday and Sunday, March 12th and 13th, at the Fredericksburg Spring Home Show at the Expo Center in Fredericksburg, Virginia. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with cracked tomatoes, sappy beetles, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a very common problem towards the end of the season is when your ripening tomatoes crack and split. And what does that do? It attracts all sorts of opportunistic pests. We'll tell you how to prevent cracking and splitting, and thus maybe you'll never have to deal with the infamous sap beetle. Before then, though, lots of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Neil, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing good, Neil. How are you, sir?
I'm doing just fine, thanks.
And where is Neil doing just fine?
I'm in Bordertown, PA.
Oh, okay. Very good. I know where that is. Mm-hmm. What can we do for Neil in Boyertown?
Well, I'm on a mission to eradicate an invasive tree of heaven from my property. We're in an area that recently has become quarantined due to a spotted lanternfly, which is another invasive insect. And the main, her favorite host plant for egg laying of this spotted lantern fly is the Tree of Heaven. I have two pretty good sized stands on my property, probably about 20 trees each. And what I'm looking to do is, first of all, cut them down. But I would like your advice on eradicating the Tree of Heaven. Cutting down is easy. The hard part is the suckers that originate after you cut them down. And if you could help me with that, my second part of the question is, my understanding is that the Tree of Heaven has this property called, I believe it's pronounced allopathy, which is a plant's ability to excrete some kind of nutrient or poison to suppress other plants. And the Tree of Heaven has this property. My planning is to get rid of the Tree of Heaven and plant evergreens, but I'm wondering if there's any way I can neutralize the soil prior to planting the evergreens.
Okay, well, this is a very thoughtful response on your part. I have been following the progress of this pest, the lanternfly, because I believe they go after peach trees eventually, right?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Right, and I'm just outside of the quarantine zone. I mean, literally, man, I could walk to where they found one of the egg clusters.
Okay.
So, you know, I've just been kind of tapping my foot, waiting and hoping. And I wasn't really aware that the Tree of Heaven was their preferred host, but that would make sense because I think they both originate in the same part of Asia, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So now one thing I'm not certain of is that the Tree of Heaven needs any help. The allopathic properties you talk about are best known for the black walnut. The okay. black walnut tree, every part of the tree contains this substance called juglone that does inhibit the growth of at least half of the other known plants in the plant world. Some plants are immune, but some plants can't grow anywhere near the drip line of a black walnut, most famously tomatoes. It's one of the big causes of tomato failure where people are scratching their heads or doing everything right, but they're not looking at the black walnut 50 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
So the good news and the bad news is no matter what you do, you got to get these roots out of the ground.
Hmm.
If there's one thing that I think I've been explaining over and over again on this show is people who get trees cut down, they get them ground and everything like that, and then they want to plant another tree. And right. I'm going, don't you realize that there's a plug in the ground? You know, there's no soil there. There's just this root system that's going to take 20 years to decompose. So there's two ways to do this. If you wanted to be once and done, you'd go out and you get a backhoe, and you would have a grand old time. Now, we're talking a man with a dangerous piece of power equipment tearing apart the earth, but on a mission from God. I mean, all of these things coming together, you know.
Sure.
The other way is the rope-a-dope method. Where you would, you know, and I think you'd still prevent the lanternfly from being especially attracted. And what you do there is you would just go out the first season and you would cut every single one of these you could find to the ground.
Okay.
And then you would allow them to regrow, you know, send up their shoots, their stumps. They regrow from everything. And I'd say about halfway through the season, you would cut them back again. And then cut them back again in the fall. And do that for about 2 years. At the end of the second year, you would see instead of vigorous shoots coming out of the ground, you're seeing real skinny stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the third year, you probably would have exhausted the root system without the expense and the heavy equipment and the danger of personal amputation.
Okay.
And then once you did that, it'd be a relatively simple matter to just dig up and remove any existing root systems. Or then when you've got it really down to where they're just sending up tiny shoots, you could let them grow. And then you could soak the new emerging plant with one of these natural herbicides, the iron-based herbicides or soap-based herbicides. And then I would just put the white pines in the ground. But I don't think there's going to be any residual thing with Tree of Heaven. I mean, Tree of Heaven, if it prevents other trees from growing, it's because it's such a bully underground. There's such an extensive root system.
Gotcha.
So I would keep hacking the top growth away, and then you're going to have to do some root removal. But it'd be pretty easy once you got all the big stuff out of the way for a couple of years.
Okay. Well, I'll give that a shot. It's obviously going to be a, you know, it's going to take a couple years to get this thing eliminated, if I can even totally eliminate it.
But as soon as you get started, you remove the main target.
Yes.
For the fly.
Understood. Mm-hmm.
All right, Neil?
I'll give it a shot. Thanks for your advice, Mike. I love the show, and I appreciate you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, sir. You have good luck there.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
1-888-346-9499. Maureen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Maureen. Where are you?
We're in southern Pennsylvania.
Okay. Whereabouts?
West Grove. We're actually just north of the Maryland-Delaware border.
Okay.
About 7 miles. So we're southern. We're in Chester County.
Okay. Very good. What can we do for Maureen?
Well, we have boxwoods in front of our house.
Yes.
The front facing north. And one of my boxwoods is turning yellow in the middle. They are about 4 or 5 years old.
Right.
And it happened last year to the same plant. Now, I'm wondering if that's because it gets very little sun.
Compared to the other plants in the row?
The other three in the front, yeah.
Huh. Well, do you feed your boxwood?
Yeah, with, I can't think of what he calls it now, but yes, he does.
And is it a chemical plant food?
Yes, it is.
Well, I would stop doing that. And are they mulched underneath?
Yes, they are.
And what are they mulched with?
I would assume it's shredded bark.
Right.
Because it's done by a company. We live in a 55-plus community.
You say you're in a community and you don't have any control over the mulch?
Right. They put it down.
Hmm. That's going to be tough. Is there any, I guess there's no way that you could ask them to do compost there instead?
Well, we could try. You know, but it's an HOA, so you know how that goes.
Yes. One of our biggest complaints is people move into these places that are ruled by homeowner associations, and they had no idea that the landscaping would be that chemically intensive. There are two pests that attack a boxwood. One is a leaf miner, M-I-N-E-R. It makes little, like, roadmap things in the needles. And this pest is really bizarre. When it's active in the spring, it's so loud you can hear it. It sounds like your boxwoods are crackling. So this spring, you want to, you know, pay attention, you know, go listen to your boxwoods like once a week in the spring.
Uh-huh.
There's also nematodes that attack boxwood sometimes, but it wouldn't be just one plant in a row. Now, is there any reason to believe that maybe people are walking their dogs and this is like a prime spot for them to...
No, because this is right up against the house, but I'll tell you, it is right behind the electrical wires that come into the house.
Right.
I don't know if that means anything. You know, that's where the meters are.
Right. And are they underground?
And they are.
Yeah. So probably what happened is when the meters were put in, the root system was disrupted or there's not a lot of a root system down there. But you guys are the ones doing the feeding, right?
Right.
Okay. So
Polytone is what he uses.
That's not a chemical fertilizer, but I'm not sure it's good for boxwoods. It's my understanding that boxwoods may actually like an alkaline soil.
Uh-huh.
So you may be accidentally giving them the wrong kind of natural plant food. What I would do is just back off. Don't feed them anything this spring. Give those plants, the ones that are coming out of the root system, with the yellow needles, see if you can find some nice compost to put around the base of the plant. But in this case, even though Hollytone is a nice natural fertilizer, I think the acidity is actually hurting the boxwoods. That's something we discovered years ago. It surprised me. So less is more when it comes to that. If they're going to put the mulch down after they leave, go out and spread it a little thinner if you can so it's not covering the base of the plants.
Right.
But I think if you back off of acidifying the soil, there's a good chance that plant could recover.
Well, I hope so, because we're not of the age where we can take care of it ourselves either.
Well, this case, maybe the trying to take care of it was actually working against you. Just sit back for a season and let the plant recover.
Okay.
Great. All right, Maureen?
Yes.
All right,
Mike.
Good luck
Thank
this
you.
Summer. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Ryan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, how are you guys?
I am just fine, Ryan. How are you, sir?
I'm doing pretty good over here in Indiana, Columbus, Indiana.
All right, very good. What can we do for Ryan in Indiana?
Well, I'm growing pepper plants indoors, and they're exotic hot peppers, the Carolina Reapers and up to that magnitude. And my question is I have two of them. The first one is, this first season, I didn't get a lot of fruit. I'm thinking it might have been because I planted them so late in the season. Mm-hmm. And then those plants that I planted last season, they're probably 3.5 foot now, 2, 2.5, somewhere in there. And they look pretty healthy. They're being grown indoors under grow lights.
Good.
And then my next season, I've got 130 more peppers that I'm going to plant, but I'm getting ready to start the seedling process now.
Right.
Because some of them take so long to get to full growth. Can you over-fertilize them and hurt your fruit production? That's one question. And then the other question then is, when I go to prune my pepper plants for the to overwinter them, is there any technique that I should be looking to use? Do I cut them all the way down to their main branch, or do I just
trim
them a little bit?
No wonder you're not getting any peppers. You're cutting all the branches off. Now, are these plants that were growing outside in the summer that you moved inside as the summer ended and the fall began?
Yes.
Okay. And you say they got a little bit of a late start. When did you put them outside? Like, what month?
When did I put them outside?
Yeah.
Probably late June.
Okay. Yeah. You know, one thing about these exotic peppers, and not only hot peppers, but the big blocky bell peppers, the ones with the real big four-lobed fruits, they have a days to maturity of like 100, 120. And that's from when you set out a pretty good size plant. So it is not unusual. That's one of the reasons why I'm always talking about bringing your peppers inside at the end of the season. Not only do they perennialize pretty well, but it is very normal to have plants full of green peppers at that time of year that haven't had enough time to ripen up. And it wouldn't be a problem for you if you were down like in the Carolinas or something. But up in Indiana, right, you don't have a very long season.
Exactly.
So I think you're doing fine. What have you been feeding them?
Well, at the beginning of the spring, I started with bone meals in the mix.
Okay.
And then I was told to sprinkle on Epsom salt and fish parts or whatever you want to call it from Alaska.
Oh, okay. Are you actually talking about the fish fertilizer that has the name brand Alaska?
Yes.
Yeah. I stopped using that. I used to use that when I was a beginning gardener. It has a very high chlorine element to it. And you don't want to be feeding a lot of just basic fish because that is an excess of nitrogen. And nitrogen will slow down the flowering of your plants.
Okay.
If you look around at better independent garden centers and online, you'll find other products that are a combination of fish and seaweed.
Okay.
Those are more balanced. And worm castings, believe it or not, which you can either make yourself by recycling your garbage through a worm bin at home, or you can buy worm castings. They're one of the easiest organic plant foods to buy. Worm castings are perfect for pepper plants. Now, what I would suggest, I mean, I know everybody prunes these plants when they bring them in, and I guess if you have a limited space to keep them in, that makes sense. But if you have a situation where you can keep the lights right above them and not have to reduce them in height, there's absolutely no reason to prune them. You know, if you wanted to, you could give them, I don't even know what I'd call it, a stimulation pruning when you put them out for the season when it gets warm outside. I'm just talking about like a little bit off the top, literally like 2 inches off every branch. And that would just be to stimulate more growth and more flowering. There's no advantage to taking off large sections unless you have to. And one thing you've probably learned by now, the real important thing to do when you bring these things in for the winter is wash them down over and over again with sharp streams of water, because aphids love to hide on pepper plants.
Yeah, I found that out this season.
That's not your fault. There's just something about these plants that they go for. So when you pot them up, or if you keep them in pots all season long, when you're ready to bring them inside, take them to like a porch, get a high-pressure nozzle on your, but just on a regular garden hose nozzle, and really hold the plants with one hand and really blast every little corner of it with the high-pressure water. Then go inside and kill a couple of hours and come back and do it at least one more time before you bring them inside.
All right. Will do.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
And you guys have a great day.
And you have a hot season next year.
Yeah, I'm hoping for it.
All right. Good luck, Rye.
Thanks. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody that the famed Philadelphia Flower Show, this year celebrating the 100th anniversary of our national park system, will be held March 5th through the 13th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center in downtown Philly. But don't go looking for all the details at theflowershow.com just yet, because we'll be right back with cracked tomatoes, sappy beetles, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. Cracked tomatoes, split tomatoes, and sappy beetles. We'll also take lots more of your fabulous phone calls right after this.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties, and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
And now back to your fabulous phone calls at 1 888-346-9499. Keith, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike.
Hello, Keith. How are you, man?
I'm fine. How are you?
I am doing just ducky today, thank you. And where is Keith fine?
Well, I'm calling from Kill Devil Hills, North Carolina on the Outer Banks.
I know that area well. That's the where the Wright brothers did their initial flight testing, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, my brother vacations in the Outer Banks, and my wife and I visited there. This was many years ago, but there was a magnificent kite shop.
Oh, yeah.
Right near where the sand hills were that they took off in that little plane.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a beautiful area you live in there, man. Beautiful part of the ocean.
Oh, yeah.
So what can we do for Keith in the Outer Banks?
I have a raised bed garden, a small one, about 5 by 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been growing tomatoes in it for years, and I know what you, and they're getting worse and worse. And I know that you had said that you can't continue growing tomatoes in the same soil.
Right.
I didn't know whether to dig it out and how deep I had to change the soil, or should I just put something else in there and build a new bed?
I got to tell you, Keith, option number two would be the smart money, especially if you want to grow more things, if you want to grow some peppers, some eggplants, because let's say you build a new raised bed. And did you say it's 5 by 10?
Yeah.
You don't want to build them that wide. 10 feet long is fine. But the idea of a raised bed is the soil stays perfect if you don't step in it. And for most of us, that would be 4 foot wide. That way we can reach the center from either.
I don't step in it.
Yeah. So maybe make it a little thinner. But if you've worked it out, that would be great. And then you can grow tomatoes in the brand new bed with, quote, impunity for at least the first 2 years, especially if you have good, rich, organic soil. I know your soil there is naturally sandy. If you just add a lot of compost to it, you get a tremendously rich soil that drains very well, and that's just perfect for growing tomatoes. And then in that first bed, just literally almost grow anything and everything else, cucumbers, eggplant, peppers. And at the end of, say, the third year, then you can switch back because the verticillium and the fusarium wilt that had been building up in your original raised bed will be gone. So, you know, you can just rotate the beds every 3 years, and you might see a little bit of yellowing at the bottom of the plant later in the season. But if you keep up a rotation, even just between those two beds, and making sure there's 2 years in between tomatoes in each one, you should be able to get away with murder.
And I should build it about the same as the other one, about 12 inches deep?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay, good, good. I did have another question.
Go ahead.
That was really helpful. I have what I was told is a Rose of Sharon. I also have a bush called a red tip bush.
Mm-hmm.
And both have grown out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know when I could cut them back and how far I could do that.
Well, do you care about the blooms? Or do you just want to...
No, not right now. I'd rather get them out of the way. The Rose of Sharon has been growing crooked because there was a tree in the way blocking its light, which the tree is now gone.
Oh, okay.
And I wanted to get it straight again.
Well, you know, it will slowly straighten up even on its own. I had a gold dust plant that got flattened by Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy. And over 3 or 4 years, it straightened itself back up again. It's amazing what photosynthesis can do.
It's about 10 feet tall. Would it help if I did straighten it, if I cut it back at least halfway?
No. You don't want to do that. What you want to do is in the spring, wait until both plants are growing again, you know, about 2 weeks after you see new growth on each one.
Right.
And then if the plant is 10 feet tall, you can cut it by 2 feet all around.
Okay.
And then about a month, maybe 6 weeks later, you can do it again.
Okay.
And we're talking like the maximum now of safe pruning because it's obviously going to regrow some in between. But don't prune it after about the middle to even the beginning to middle of summer. Just do two relatively conservative prunings in the spring, and then next year do the same thing again. And then every year after that, you should only have to, like, cut it back by, like, 8 inches or so to keep it to the size you want.
Oh, good. I'm glad I asked you because I was told by somebody that's supposed to be knowledgeable that I should cut them all the way back next month.
Sometimes some plants, like for instance a holly, can tolerate that kind of severe, what's called rejuvenation pruning, but they look terrible for the first 3 years afterwards.
Right.
Slow and steady wins the race, Keith.
Okay.
All right, man?
Thank you very much.
Take care, man.
And bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. George, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How you doing, boss, with the hot sauce?
I am doing well, George. I'm spinning the wax.
That's great. I'm out here freezing, wishing I had a mojito in my hand.
Oh, thoughts of Cuba 2 years ago. I developed such a serious mojito problem visiting that beautiful little island in January. I never wanted to come back.
My gosh, you know, and the mojito, the one ingredient that I started growing in my garden was mint.
Where are you, George?
I'm in Garden Valley, not far from Philly, just south in Delaware County.
And you made the mistake of planting mint in the ground, did you?
That is correct. I put it in my garden, you know, kind of, you know, near the tomatoes and zucchini, and I thought I could, you know, just trim it and, you know, it would... I thought wrong.
Yeah. Mint is famous for taking over. It is the 800-pound gorilla of the garden. How many years has it been growing?
This is my second season. This season coming up will be the third.
Yeah, mint will not be restrained. Mint will relish a battle with you, and it will watch with glee as you flail in exhaustion. So I have a similar quote problem in that I grow lemon balm in my garden, which is not really a member of the mint family, but kind of gets honorable mention because it's just as invasive as the actual mints themselves. And what I do, and I grow a lot, I want a lot of lemon balm because it's a great natural insect repellent. So at the beginning and end of every season, I rip all of the lemon balm out of the ground. I totally saturate the soil of my garden. And I go around to every plant and grab it down by the soil line and pull oh so gently and get it, quote, all out of the ground, roots and all. And I do this really thoroughly so that way I only grow about a dozen lemon balm plants.
Okay.
Really, if you work at it in the spring and really try to eradicate it, and then again in the fall, work at it before the garden goes to sleep for the year, again, really soak the soil, pull up all the plants you can, then you'll probably reach, at least I have, a kind of a stasis where you get as much as you want, maybe a tiny bit more, but you do have room to grow other things.
Okay.
Now, if you find that it's totally invaded a bed and you have raised bed systems and you really want to reclaim a bed, well, you can solarize that bed. But in Pennsylvania, you'd need the whole season. You'd level the soil, totally saturate it with water for like 12 hours, stretch clear plastic over top, like on the 1st of June, use rocks to hold the plastic down tightly over that bed. And by the end of August, the soil would be solarized. There wouldn't be any living roots or diseases or insects left in the soil.
Yeah,
if you go to our website, go to You Bet Your Garden, go to Garden Answers A to Z at the top of the page, and click on S, you'll see an article on soil solarization that gives you all the details and links to a lot of university studies that explain why it has to be done this way, and they really take it down to the tiny, minutest detail. But it works brilliantly. You just lose that one growing area for a summer.
Now, the mint that I had at the end of the season got so high, some of it was almost 2 feet tall, you know, and it was seeding and stuff like that. So what you're saying is I should just start pulling that out, and then I'm assuming the seeds will have taken, they'll start taking in the spring somewhere, and just start pulling those little shoots out.
You still want to grow the mint. You want to drink a lot of mojitos, right?
That's correct.
Good man. As soon as you see the first flower, that's when you want to saturate the soil and pull up as many plants as you can. Don't wait for the flowers to set seed. As soon as you see those flowers start to form, that's the ideal time to harvest the mint anyway, because the flavor is going to change.
Okay.
After it flowers. So right. I would knock it back in the spring. And then when you got those big plants, as soon as they start to flower, they're really easy to pull out of wet soil in the summertime.
Okay, yeah.
I think you can do this, George.
All right, I'll be listening, and I'll call you back if it works.
All right. All right, and make us a mojito.
There you go. I'll send some your way.
All right, take care, man.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Don't blame beetles for your cracked tomatoes. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started by reading this week's question.
Sure, Mike. David from Traverse City, Michigan writes, for the last 3 years, half-inch-long, slender black beetles have infested my tomatoes. Are they flea beetles? They only show up in August and only go after my tomatoes. They enter through any crack or bruise that happens, usually when the fruit is approaching ripeness, and can do a lot of damage. I have resorted to picking the fruit a little early before the pests can get in there, and then allowing the tomatoes to ripen on my windowsill.
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with harvesting your tomatoes a little early and then letting them finish ripening up inside, but not on a windowsill. Direct sun can cause tomatoes to rapidly lose flavor. So can we please put this ancient but totally incorrect gardening advice to rest? And flea beetles are black, but they're really tiny. And in my garden, they're only a pest early in the season, and they've never gone after my tomatoes.
Right. Flea beetles are famous for attacking eggplant, making the leaves look like they were hit by lots of teeny tiny shotgun blasts.
Exactly. There's an entry in our A to Z Garden Answers section that offers some suggestions on their control, but we're not going to go into any kind of flea beetle detail here because David sent a follow-up to let us know that he had correctly identified his pests as sap beetles.
Sap beetles? Never heard of them.
Well, neither had I, but I did some research and it looks like this idea is right on. It's a fairly large family of beetles with a variety of common names, like strawberry sap beetle and picnic beetle. They're about a quarter of an inch long, and they typically do show up late in the season and on fruits that are already damaged.
So they're like a lot of other pests that don't do the initial damage, but move in after the fruits are already compromised, like ants and millipedes.
Right, these and other opportunistic pests always get the blame because gardeners see them on the fruits. But an excellent online bulletin from the University of Minnesota Extension stresses that these beetles are almost always only found on fruits that were already damaged or just overripe.
So all you have to do is not have any damaged fruit in your garden.
Yeah, good luck with that one, especially at the end of the season when almost every garden has some dead soldier tomatoes on the ground to attract pests like this. But a clean garden is the goal, especially if these little buggers have gotten used to coming around. And all you need to initiate this cure is one of the most important steps in basic gardening, the daily inspection. You want to visually check your plants every morning. Harvest anything that's ready, and remove any damaged or cracked fruits. If the damage is minor, cut the bad parts off and use the rest. If the fruit is really trashed, compost it in a closed container far away from your actual garden. Or even better, use those damaged fruits to bait sap beetle traps.
Oh, like Japanese beetle traps.
Pretty much. Put your damaged fruits into a container that the beetles can easily fly into, but not out of, like a quart-sized jar with a small hole punched in the lid. Then hang the traps on the outskirts of your garden, not near the plants you're trying to protect.
That's exactly like Japanese beetle traps. You don't want to lure the pests too close, or they may choose the live plants over the traps.
Right, and I would begin this defense early in the season. Turns out these beetles overwinter as adults and lay their eggs near rotting or fermenting fruit in the spring. So starting out with a squeaky clean garden is really important. Don't leave your rotten tomatoes on the ground over winter. I'd also urge people with this problem to build raised beds if they don't already have them. Raised beds can help prevent the most common form of damage that attracts these pests, splitting. That's splitting, not spitting. Splitting is when the skin of a tomato splits open. It's caused by uneven watering, especially when a deluge follows a drought. But poor drainage makes it much worse. And raised beds are always going to have superior drainage. I'd also choose my tomato varieties very carefully.
Are some tomatoes resistant to sap beetles?
Not directly, but a lot of varieties are resistant to the splitting and cracking that attracts these and the other opportunistic pests. Splitting occurs when the skin of the fruit can't expand as fast as the inner part of the growing tomato. But some varieties are naturally better at resisting the problem. And many varieties naturally resist cracking, developing those big cracks around the very top of the fruit near the stem. So read catalog descriptions carefully and look for varieties that specifically say they're resistant to cracking and splitting. After a couple seasons of growing tomatoes that hold together well, the cycle of sappiness should be broken.
If only the same could be said of you.
Hey! Well, that sure was some interesting information about avoiding cracking, splitting, and sappy beetles now, wouldn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. And that's it. We are out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And please include your location, especially if you're certain that we don't need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location, but where you will find the answers to all those questions you were going to email us, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luniz, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Lauren Elkins keep our website sap-free. Cracked Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Split Open Al Banks is our editor. A sappy welcome to our new production assistant, Eileen Kelly. I'm your cracked and creaky host, Mike McGrath. And hey, somebody get all these little beetles off me so I can, ow, hey, they bite, ow, so I can say, I'll see you, hey, Alexis, ow, ow, Eileen, don't use wait till last week, get these beetles off me, Ringo, Paul, get out of here. Seed starting time is fast approaching. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll review the basics of growing your own plants with a focus on proper feeding, plus your fabulous phone calls.